history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some great stories in your neighborhood if you take the time to listen to them. Men and women from our greatest generation, we hear from them every week on this program. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired. Today, perhaps if you spent a little time in Oakhurst, California with Sarge Sargentini, you might be amazed at what great shape he's in at 91 and all the things he's got around this property. You can look at some pictures at the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or hometownheroesradio.com. But let's go way back. A young boy, your family moves from Arizona to California, and you had two brothers, two sisters. Growing up in gold country, was the gold rush still somewhat recent history as you're growing up in the 20s and 30s?
Yes, it was. We lived in Bear Valley, and there were miners all over the place right there. In fact, I worked in a mine.
What'd you do in the mine?
I was a trammer. That's pushing a gold cart in and out of the mines to empty the ore that the miner had dug up.
I think most people probably wouldn't know the answer to this. They think gold rush, they think, 1849 and maybe 20 years after that. They don't know that in the 1920s and 30s, there might still have been a little gold. How much gold was still left at that point?
Well, there was enough of them that there were at least a dozen well-known mines. They were famous around the area in the Golden Key. The Pine Tree Mine were some of the big ones, and the Dilt, where I think they took out a 50-pound gold nugget one time. So there was lots of mines, and I was fortunate enough to work at the Pine Tree as a trammer.
And I'm just guessing here. I'm imagining myself in your shoes. If I'm growing up at that time and I'm working in a gold mine and I've got two brothers and two sisters, I bet there was a lot of daydreaming among those five kids of, hey, maybe we're going to find the giant gold nugget here or there. Did you ever go looking?
Yes. I used to have a sluice box in the creek in Mariposa Creek right down below the house. We built the house, and the creek was right down below us, so I used to do a lot of panning. I didn't get rich, but I picked up some gold. And we lived in an old stagecoach road, and while we were digging the house foundation, I remember my brother picked up a silver dollar, that, oh gosh, I must have been 1,000 years old, but he got rid of it in town for candy. So we never did find out how old it was or anything. Somebody took advantage of him.
The persuasive pull of sweets. Sometimes it never changes. And besides finding the mother lode, do you remember what kind of ambitions you had as a young man, what you dreamed about doing someday?
Well, there was logging, and I really didn't have any idea of what I was going to do from high school. I went into the 3Cs, and from the 3Cs, I drove truck in Alaska.
And I want to hear about that, and I understand you were there on a pretty significant date in world history there in Alaska. But for folks today, a teenager in school right now, you say the 3Cs, and I don't think they know what you're talking about. So you're a sophomore in high school, and you leave high school to join the Civilian Conservation Corps. Why did you do that? What made that decision for you?
Well, our family was poor. I had a chance to make some money, it seems like. So at $30 a month in room and board, I went into the Civilian Conservation Corps, and out of that, $25 was taken out of my pay and sent home. Mm-hmm. And I was left with the rest, which was ample because $5 bought a lot back in those days.
Especially in Alaska, I'm sure. But something tells me, as much as you do get a little dusting of snow in Mariposa County, it probably paled in comparison to what you faced in Alaska. Were you prepared for what you encountered up there?
We were in the Aleutian Islands, and it wasn't as bad as it is in the inner part of Alaska right there. We got mostly a lot of storms and rain, a lot of rain. And we did get a dusting of snow, but not drifts like, 3-4 feet deep. We were in a bay they called Tongass Bay for a year, and we built a landing strip for airplanes. I was there from the beginning till, no, not from the beginning, but close to it until the end, where we witnessed our first plane to land there, and it was Army.
Well, because by that time, something had happened. And, you know, every veteran I've ever had on this show, hundreds of them, I ask them all the same question. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Where were you, and how'd you find out? I don't think I've had anyone tell me they were in the Aleutian Islands that day. What do you remember about December 7th?
Well, I remember December 7th, we had come in from work. I was a jackhammer person at the time before I started driving truck. I remember coming in, and that night we were alerted. The island got put under martial law, and they said that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. The air raid alarm sounded that night, and we could see, we all went out into the trenches, which had been prepared by the engineers, and while we were sitting there talking and joking and what have you, because we didn't see anything, all of a sudden we saw lights up in the heavens, and we thought they were searchlights from Japanese boats, and that's what we were told. So as we watched them, they never came to anything. It was the Aurora Borealis that was shining up there, but we all had a good laugh about that, but it was serious for a while.
The Northern Lights almost got you. And I imagine you saw things change from that point on. And it's interesting. It seems like not only the being away from home, the difficult work, but even those early days after Pearl Harbor probably prepared you for what you were going to face later during World War II.
Well, I never knew that I was going into the Army, but we did get training while we were there. We were forced to live just like the soldiers did. In fact, there was a division right behind us on the same island, and they're the ones that we worked under, an engineer division, and we had Army personnel that commanded us.
So you were almost in the Army before you were in the Army, and maybe that's fitting, because I'm sure they called you Sarge long before you had any rank at all. Did you ever have some fun with that or confuse some people with them just calling you your name and your nickname?
Well, not while I was in the 3Cs. But when I was in the Army, yes, we were in formation one time. When we first got there, we didn't even know how to stand at attention hardly, but it was on a Saturday, and we were lined up, and the lieutenant hollered, "Hey, Sarge, Sarge, Sarge." And he kept, nobody moved. And he came up before me, and he says, "I mean you." And I said, "Yes, sir, yes, sir." And he says, "Take these men and take them to the barber shop and get them a hair of this." So forth, you know. So I did. The next day he apologized. He says, "I heard them calling you Sarge." He says, "So I thought you were a sergeant." So that's how I got my first promotion.
Do you remember how old you were when people first started calling you that, or when they stopped calling you Julian and went with Sarge?
Oh, it's been forever. My brother was little Sarge. I was Sarge, and my dad was big Sarge. We all went by those names there in Mariposa. Everybody knew Little Sarge and Sarge and Big Sarge.
I can imagine having a lot of fun with that in the Army. How did you end up in the Army? How did that all unfold?
So I was drafted, and I served my time, and I was a sergeant, and I came out a corporal.
How'd you pull that off? Do we want to know?
Well, I was temporary. So,
how did you feel about that? Because, you know, some guys, they didn't want to be drafted. They wanted to choose their path, and they enlisted, and they went in the Air Corps or the Navy. When you got that word and you ended up in the Army, what were your feelings about that?
I wanted to go into the Air Corps, fly a plane, but I didn't have the education for it. It takes a college education to become any kind of a flyer. So I wound up in the infantry, in the 75th Infantry.
Yeah, and you ended up in some pretty sticky situations and some pretty cold situations in Europe. But about your training, was it difficult? I've had a lot of guys tell me about infantry training and 25-mile hikes and all the different things they went through. Was that tough for you, or were you already toughened up from all that time in the CCCs?
Well, I was toughened up, yes. A lot of us couldn't make it, but I did. I went through all their training. I went through the hikes. Started up with 3-mile hikes and 7-mile hikes and overnight hikes. And we wound up with a 30-mile hike, which really was something. We started in the morning and got in at night. And to celebrate that, I think we bought all of us contributed some money, and we bought us a couple of cases of beer. And that's how we wound up for the evening.
And when you headed overseas, with the 75th Infantry Division. I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember your state of mind? Did you believe you'd be coming back to America someday, or did you wonder if you'd end up over there and not coming home?
I never gave that a thought about not coming back. I always thought I would. And we went over in one of the largest boats that they had at the time. It was a ship, the Aquitania. And that was a sister ship to the Lusitania. And it was huge. Anyway, on the way, we thought we saw periscopes and all that. But we had planes that fly over every once in a while, you know. So we never worried too much. We were just soldiers. We let the higher-ups worry.
And in an infantry division, there are a lot of different platoons, a lot of different squads, a lot of different duties. What was your job in the 75th Infantry Division?
I was with the wire team. We were special troops, and they taught us how to run lines, how to splice them, how to communicate by radio, by signs, by any way we could, from one switchboard to another. So we went from, from division to regiment, and from regiment down to company, and from company down to the units. So we always had to keep in communication. Now, I wasn't a fighting man. We followed the fighting guys, right, to wherever they went, we went. We had radios back in those days, but they were big and bulky, and sometimes you couldn't get out with them, so we always needed telephones.
And when you're using telephone, that means there has to be a physical telephone line extended from one end of that to the other, and you're one of the guys that was rolling that line?
Exactly, yes. We were taught how to climb poles and how to fix temporary overhead lines and undergrounds and all those things like that. And then we were taught how to keep them in maintenance because there was always shelling and tanks, everything that could go wrong. One tank could go roll over a line, and he'd take out a mile of line. You know, or everything that you had put in there, he'd just wrap it up in the treads. And so we had to be always on the lookout and be ready to run new ones.
And you said something there. You said, I wasn't a fighting man. I don't know that the Germans knew that. It's not like you had a big red vest on that said, don't shoot me. I think you were probably in as much danger as anybody else. When was your first taste of it? When was the first moment where you realized, hey, I could get killed out here?
That was in the Soy Houghton area. It was Christmas. We went into fighting just around Christmas right there. We were in the lines during Christmas. I remember it was just out of Soy that I was in my first blow up. Somebody stepped on a mine, or what happened, we don't know. But anyway, there was about 8 engineers that were killed that night, you know. So, and before that, our unit had been in combat, and we lost quite a few men. I'll never know just how many, but we knew that we had lost a lot of them. And we stood out in the snow with our dark uniforms. We didn't have camouflage like the Germans did. They had white uniforms, and we didn't. We stood out like stumps out there in the field, in a white field, so we were good targets.
And this is what would become known as the Battle of the Bulge. This is about a week into that, and the 75th was called in as part of that. So you mentioned that incident, and I, you know, not to get gory or harp on it, but just so people understand what you went through. So this is at nighttime, and pretty close to you, a mine goes off. It kills 8 guys.
I was blown up in the same thing, and I suffered a broken pelvis bone at the time, and that was about the extent of my injury on that one right there.
So you must have been pretty close to this mine that went off.
We were. I don't know just how close it was, but I remember the guys laying around, and one of the lieutenants right there, he crawled over and he says, are you hurt, soldier? I said, no. He says, I don't think I am, you know, because I was deaf, but I could make him out. And I said, no, I'm not, because I could move. And he says, okay, help me. So we dragged a few carcasses out of the way and took some over to by that time the medics had set up a temporary aid station, and we took some boys over there. So anyway, that was my first taste of real getting into the action.
Well, you say that's your first taste. I mean, that's a smack in the face. And you're describing it. I just want to be clear. So this mine explosion, it knocked you from your feet into the snow?
Yes. It knocked me up against a wall. And I don't know just how I hit the wall, but with my back. And I think it was a sharp box or something, because there was a lot of crates laying around between the wall and the crates. I hit something, and it hit my back end. Anyway, that was my first taste of it, the Relax. And before that, it was just running lines. We thought of, you know, we kept looking for relief. They told us we'd be relieved in 3 days. We kept looking for that third day. Well, the third day came and there was no relief. And then the fourth day and the fifth day and the sixth day. And it went on like that. Pretty soon we just gave up, you know.
Again, I'm just, you know, imagining what this must have been like for you. And this is Christmas time, 1944. So you're only 20 years old. You're out here half a world away from all your family. It's freezing cold. You get blown off your feet into a wall. You can't hear because of the concussion of this mine. And then you just said something that you guys, in trying to help with the situation, you were dragging carcasses through the snow. Now, those carcasses a minute before were your buddies, guys that you'd been serving with out there. How did you handle the emotions in that moment, or were you just completely numb to it?
They were engineers, and I knew some of them, but you never get real close to another unit. You know, you see them and work with them and like that, but you don't know them very well. And while we were there anyway, after that little deal was over, we were still in the area. It was New Year's Eve, and we opened up with everything that artillery had in the background and the army had in the background. They threw everything they could for a New Year's present to the Germans, and they did. They pounded the heck out of them for a long time, but then the Germans threw some of it back at us, you know, but not as much. But I remember that barrage right there that came.
And I need to stop you there because it's time for a break. But when we come back, we're going to find out what happened next. And Wyatt has left Sarge Sargentini with a strong aversion to a song you might enjoy each holiday season. To see what Sarge looked like then and what great shape he's still in at 91, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most from their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. It's simple, rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, a proud supporter of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 91-year-old Sarge Sargentini of Oakhurst, California. He served with the Bulge Busters of the 75th Infantry Division in World War II. When we left off, he had described a brutal artillery barrage on New Year's Eve, 1944, right in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge. And it's amazing what kind of specific memories and moments will stay with you for 70 years and flood back in your mind when something triggers it. And Sarge, you have something like that when it comes to that part of the bulge.
Afterwards, back at the CP, somebody had a radio, and they were Bing Crosby was singing White Christmas, and that always got to me, you know, that funny how some things will remind you.
That's not the kind of White Christmas you had in mind. You're out there in the snow in the coldest winter Europe had ever seen, but he says, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. You were probably dreaming of coming back home, huh?
Well, I wasn't dreaming of a white Christmas, that's for sure. I knew it wasn't. I was wishing I was home, yes.
And every year, I'm sure you hear that song once or twice during the holiday season. What comes to mind for you when you hear that come on the radio?
I turn it off or I walk away.
It's just too painful for you to remember what you saw?
Well, it brings back a lot of memories, and sometimes, you know, something will... It's just like when I went by the Vietnam Wall, this honor flight, it just does something to you. It just brings a, when you see a lot of dead people and you picture them in your mind, you know, you see them. And then to know there's 400,000 guys, I didn't see that many. But I can see, I can see people laying all over the snow and like that. I see them get loaded up in trucks after it's all over with, and they're just like cordwood. They threw them in the back end of the trucks and frozen bodies. So it never leaves you. You think back. You something reminds you of it.
Well, as you share that, I'm thinking of what's inscribed at the National World War II Memorial, where all those gold stars are, representing 406,000 Americans who died in World War II. It says, "Here we mark the price of freedom." And when you think the price of freedom, do you think of what you saw at the Battle of the Bulge?
Yes. I don't spend much time thinking about it or anything like that. You know, you start thinking about it, then you start dreaming about it, and it gets to you. So I guess I'm cold-hearted, maybe you might say, because I wipe it out.
Well, that's self-preservation, because a lot of guys still have those flashbacks 70 years later, and I hear what you're saying with that. That said, most people alive today, maybe they've heard of the Battle of the Bulge, but they don't know what it was really like. And I realize it was different. There are a ton of American servicemen involved in this, and every experience was different. But you hear everyone talk about the cold. How cold was it, and what kind of conditions did you have to deal with? What kind of accommodations did you have?
Well, we didn't have the best of accommodations, but we had it better than the front line boys. They had to sleep in their foxholes, and at least we got to go back to the regiment where we had billets sometimes, and sometimes we didn't, but at least we weren't sleeping in mud and water and like that. Now, those boys really went through hell. I remember freezing my little feet off, but not like they did, you know. At least I wore big, heavy boots, and those rubber boots, and used to wrap my feet up with torn-up army blankets.
With that experience at the Battle of the Bulge and the one you shared where the mine goes off, eight guys very close to you are killed, you're knocked against the wall, so you're injured. You even said you broke your pelvis but didn't get medical attention at the time. You had shared when you went overseas, you didn't give a thought to, I might not come home. After that happened and you were that close to it, did it change your perspective moving forward?
Yes, I was kind of worried every time. And every time we heard a buzz bomb, one of those robot planes.
So for people who don't know, the buzz bomb, like you said, robot's a good word for it. It's unmanned, but it's flying and it's ticking away and you don't know when it's going to fall from the sky, right?
Exactly. As long as you could hear it coming, you worried about it. But as soon as it got over you, then you could quit worrying because you knew that once it started down, it was going to be away from you. I had one narrow escape in Liège where we saw it coming. We heard it first, and then we saw it, and it flew right over us and went across from us maybe a quarter mile or so. But it blew up a lot, and we were on convoy at the time, so we never knew just what the effects of it were. When we first got into combat, they put me on guard. Saw my first buzz bomb then. At first, I thought it was tracer because we had an air raid that night, and the tracers were just flying all over, and I saw this big red blob going, and I thought it was a tracer, but it didn't go out. And it was a buzz bomb, and it came down about maybe, oh, probably a half a mile from me. But I heard the explosion, and luckily, nothing around me.
I've heard a lot of different perspectives from a lot of different guys, but I'm just listening to your story from the mine to the buzz bomb to, I'm sure, what were ever-present 88 shells heading your guys' way as well. It almost seems like you're helpless, like you're not in control. You don't know when your number's going to get called. How did you deal with that? Did you believe that someone was protecting you? Did you say, hey, I hope I'm lucky today? How did you think of all that?
I never gave that a thought. I thought I was just lucky. At that time, I wasn't religious or anything like that. So, but there's a lot of praying whenever you're in close quarters like that. You know, you think, if I ever get out of this, I'm going to go to church, you know, and this and that. I'm going to believe and all that. So there's a lot of atheists that probably turned religious.
So that's not a myth. You actually found yourself in some situations where, even though it wasn't a regular habit for you, you found yourself praying.
Exactly, yes. I did that countless times. And there were some funny incidents too, you know, when my buddy and I had been looking over a canal. At the time, we were in a broken up house that had been bombed, and we were looking across the canal to see if we could see. There was activity on the other side. There were Germans, and we could see over there and see movement and see cars and what have you. And all of a sudden, a shell hit the house that we were on. We started getting out of there, but as we were going up, it had ripped up the floor, and the Germans, the people that occupied the house at the time, had buried all their money, had stored all their money in between the subfloor, I guess they'd called it, and the regular floor. And there was millions of dollars right there, because German money just flew out of there in bundles. And that money out there, they counted in 500,000 marks and 100,000 marks and 200,000, and like that, you know, big numbers. So we grabbed out all the big numbers that we could, because we thought, man, we're rich, you know. I still probably have some of them left right there, but we found out that they weren't worth anything because the German government was kaput.
Yeah, that's what happens. But it sure was fun while it lasted in those moments, huh?
Yes, it was. It was funny.
I'm sure there are some other lighthearted moments like that. What can you tell us about the relationships you built with the guys you served with, and how you felt about them, and how much trust or dependability you guys had to have in each other?
Well, we did. I had two very good friends. One we called Snake. His name was W.H. Moore. And the other one was McIntosh, Clifford McIntosh. And we were very close. We built a lot of close friendships while we were there, our bunk mates and like that. But none is real close, you know, buddies. It was just like knowing the people that you went to school with. You probably only had one or two real close friends. The rest of them were friends.
Did you notice a difference after the bulge? Did things change as far as what you encountered, even what kind of work you had to do?
Yes, we were kind of sent, I don't know if it was to clean up and like that, but we went to a resort town, it seemed like, a place called Plattenberg. And that was just like going up to Yosemite or up to Wawona, you know. It was a beautiful area like that, and it hadn't been touched by the war. We took some of the best billets around there, and then all we did was police the area. We would go out looking for Germans returning themselves in all over, and we just went all over the country looking. As far as work, we never did any work or anything. We just enjoyed the vacation that we were on until we got the news that Roosevelt was dead, and everybody was sad about that, I remember. And after that, we came home. Well, we didn't all come home. We came home by the numbers, those people that had higher numbers than we had would come home first, and those with the lesser numbers. I only had 55 points at the time, so I was kind of in the middle.
I may be wrong on this, but just listening to your story and trying to read between the lines and put two and two together here, you're talking about your points. One thing that would have given you more points is if you had the Purple Heart, and it sure sounds like that incident with the mine would have made you eligible for the Purple Heart.
Well, to me, a wound is something that you have to taken care of, to be hospitalized with, you know, that you, very serious. Mine weren't that serious. I could walk. It wasn't until way later that I went to, when we got sent back to France for coming home, then I went to the doctor. But before that, I had shrapnel. It got me in the arm right there. I'd had my arm wrapped around a cement pole. A bullet hit the pole right there and split, and took my arm all the way across here, and I had pieces up in my arm there, right there for years, until they just disappeared.
So besides breaking your pelvis, you had the length of your arm wounded, and you actually had pieces of shrapnel still in your arm, but you never wanted the Purple Heart.
No, well, I never thought of it. You know, at that time, it was not a laughing matter. No, a Purple Heart is not a laughing matter. But it seems like some guys that were in the hospital with VD, they were getting Purple Hearts. So it says anybody can get a Purple Heart, you know. And I didn't know that it was going to be worth anything, or I would try my best to get them, you know. So I got that. I got my butt, and I got a piece of shrapnel went through my helmet right there.
Where was that, the shrapnel through your helmet?
In Burtonville, we were caught behind the lines. So we were shelled with mortars from the Germans and from our own artillery. They thought we were Germans, and they knew we were Americans. So anyway, we got the heck out of there. Again, we were following some engineers when my guys, he got caught in the butt with shrapnel too. It hit about 10 feet from us, and you can't dig in the snow. I mean, you can dig in the snow, but you can't get past that layer of ice underneath it. Yeah. So we were down as far as we could go.
And this was friendly fire?
We don't know, because it was coming from both sides, but we got out of there. The lieutenant was trying to get out to tell him to stop, you know. Whether they heard, I don't know. Our telephone wasn't doing any good because we hadn't connected anything. We were still following, so it wasn't a funny situation. But when, like, my guy was down and we tried to tear his pants off to get to the wound, and he said, no, he says, I'll pull him down. He says, I don't want to freeze to death. This is because we were going to cut his pants off. Anyway, he got all right. I think he got the Purple Heart because he never saw him again. He went to France to get taken care of. So, and they gave me an option with my hind end when I was blown up with that thing. I went on sick call when I got back to the rest area. And he says, well, we can do one thing. He says, we can let nature take its course, or we can send you back to some hospital there. He says, and they can cut it out. But I had heard that those guys that went back like that, they wound up in different outfits when they got well, so I didn't want to do that. I wanted to stay with my outfit. So I said, let's let nature take its course. I didn't get any medication or nothing.
Just dealt with daily pain, probably.
For a while. It disappeared, but on long rides or anything like that, you have to shift from one cheek to the other. But I don't think it's that. I think it's just old age with me.
So when was it that you did come home?
May of 1946.
So you were over there quite a while after Germany surrendered. Do you remember VE Day? Do you remember where you were and whether that was a big deal?
I was in Plattenburg, Germany at the time, at VE Day. And after that, it was, like I said, transferred from one unit to another, so accumulating enough points to come home, and wound up going to Oberammergau in Bavaria. So I spent time up there in the snow, in the high Alps, beautiful country. And we were billeted in what used to be airplane parts manufactured, you know. There were tunnels in there where they used to have their factories and like that. But anyway, we had regular billets where the Germans had lived before.
Speaking of the Germans, what kind of interactions did you have with them, with German civilians or even German soldiers before or after the surrender?
German soldiers, we never talked too much. With the civilians, yes. I got friendly with German families over there while we were there, maybe a couple of gals. There was a little girl crying one time out in Wiesbaden, Germany. And this little girl was really hysterical, crying. So I says, what's the matter? What's the matter? You know, this and that. And I think she was lost, you know. Anyway, somebody came over and she said, that's Anna Meyer was her name. The woman that, she says, she's staying with her grandmother, Anna Meyer. So they looked up Anna Meyer and met Anna Meyer. So I got friendly with her, through her, friends with her for a long time, all the time that we were there, because she used to make good cookies and stuff. So, and I would give her coffee and stuff like that. You know, she was old. She was an old woman, and so there was no romance or anything like that, you know, involved. But anyway, just through that little girl right there, Etika was her name.
I love it when we hear stories like that. Reminders that even in the midst of a horrific worldwide war, those moments of human compassion and connection are always there. We're not done yet with 91-year-old Sarge Sargentini. The rest of his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
nine veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Sarge Sargentini. He served with the 75th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II, and he's as tough and crafty as ever at age 91. Just ask his wife, Susan, who keeps him hopping in Oakhurst, California, where they have 50 chickens producing cage-free eggs you can buy if you pop in for a visit. I tried some. Pretty tasty. You might even see a chicken or two if you check out the photos and video of Sarge on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We've heard about his communications work in the Army, some of his close calls, including the mine that killed 8 engineers and injured Sarge as well. And all this time that you're over there in this massive effort to defeat the Nazi regime, were you ever aware of the concentration camps and what was happening to Jews and other political prisoners?
We liberated one of them. It had already gone through, but anyway, we were there when it was liberated. It was a small one. It wasn't like Auschwitz or Dachau or anything like that. It was a smaller one. But I still remember those uniforms that they had. They had to take care of their own uniforms, you know, and like that. But they were rags just hanging on their bodies like that. And it was a damp, wet place where they were working, and those uniforms are hung up to dry, and they were still wet, like, you know, and they had to wear those darn things, wet or not, and it was cold. Anyway, we saw quite a few. They were Russian, and they were Poles, and I think every nationality mixed up, and they were men and women.
Is that something you knew about before you got there and liberated it, or was that the first you'd ever heard of something like this?
That was the first time we saw them. We had heard about them, but we never knew anything about it, you know. So, and we were in and out just like that, so never got friendly or anything with them.
But just seeing that, I would imagine, is a bit of a shock to the system. You mentioned the uniforms. Do you remember what kind of physical condition they were in?
I don't say they were the healthiest looking people in there, but they didn't look like they were starved or anything like some of the other big camps were. I think they probably had it better in the smaller camps than the big camps. It was bad.
So even if they weren't as bad off as some of the people in some of these other camps, they weren't as close to death as those people were. These people, had you guys not liberated the camp, probably were headed toward death or a real serious end. Does that give you some satisfaction, knowing that your group came through and set them free?
Well, I don't know, because I think Patton had already gone ahead and liberated a lot of them, so they're getting liberated is like that. So I don't know if these would have suffered any if we hadn't been there. So it seems like we were just the back door, you know. The hard work had already been done. We just got there to open the door for them.
You mentioned General Patton and the push to liberate all of the camps, and I understand you were one of the last soldiers to see General Patton, old blood and guts, before his tragic automobile accident, because your convoy stopped near Mannheim, Germany in December of 1945.
We had come through this town and bypassed it, and just on the outskirts of it, we stopped for a pit stop while the lieutenants did something, or I don't know what they had to do. We're hanging out along the road right there. There was a staff car coming from the other end into the town, and somebody holler, "It's a general, it's a general," but we didn't know what general it was. So all the guys that were out on the road, on the highway, they stood at attention and saluted, and I was behind doing my thing. So all I got to do is look. Somebody hollered, "It's Patton." So as he went by, he saluted, you know, and kept on going. Don't think it was 5 minutes, we heard this crash in the town. We never paid too much attention, you know, to it. And then they said, came out that Patton had been killed in the town. So I always said that I saw Patton for the last time.
What was it like to finally come home? I know you had to wait till a year after the war ended, but when you got back to the States, what do you remember about that?
Mariposa was just a little place, and there was no big ceremonies, big hero coming home or anything like that. I got home, I had to hitch a ride from Merced and got all the way to Mariposa, and I saw my folks. They didn't even know I was coming home. I can't remember whether I told them I was coming home or anything, but Anyway, I got to Mariposa, then I walked the mile and a half home. I remember it was a lot of rejoicing, all right, you know, a lot of tears and what have you. And then it was, what am I going to do now? Because, like I said, Mariposa was nothing at the time. So I'd walk to town and I'd join the other people that I knew, the kids that were around there. And we'd sit around and hang our feet over the side of the sidewalk and watch the cars go by. Anyway, this other soldier that had been discharged, he and I got together and wanted to go to work. This was just about 2 weeks after I got home. There was nothing to do. We got bored. So he says, let's go to work. And he says, well, I hear telephone companies putting on people. So we went and got a lunch, made a lunch that night. And we went to where the telephone people met against the wall at the Gold Coin there in Mariposa. And we waited there, and a bunch of guys were already there. We didn't know who they were or anything. They were big men. Anyway, pretty soon a truck pulled up, and all the guys started loading up. And then he says, who are you guys? Well, he says, we heard that you might hire some. And it was PG&E. And he says, well, I'm not the manager. He says, I'm just the labor foreman. He says, but get in. He says, I think we need some people. So he says, they'll be up today and do the paperwork. So we did. And that's where I started with PG&E. I've worked with them for 33 years. And I've been retired 37.
After you retired from PG&E, you worked in Yosemite National Park for several years. Maybe a lot of people, when they think Yosemite, they think of bears, they think of bobcats, they think of falcons and raccoons and beautiful scenery. They probably don't think of power outages. What's one challenge you had to overcome in all those years of working in Yosemite National Park, something that a situation you had to respond to maybe that sticks out in your mind?
One time they had an outage there that took, it went out that night. They didn't call me, so they were out all night. The next day, went out there, and it was just about a half an hour job that I said, if you'd have called me last night, you'd have had power. And they were just, well, sick about it that they, you know, it was just rerouting the line from one pole to a tree and then back to the line again. A big storm had washed out the penstock and took a pole with it. So I just ran the line from the line that was still standing to a tree and then back to the other pole and got them back in service, and says, well, next time we'll call you, we'll know better.
Well, and you know, your World War II experience left you with souvenirs like the German money you were talking about. Your time with the power company and in the park left you with a lot of souvenirs too, because anyone who comes on your property here in Oakhurst sees a lot of different signs and they say, where in the world did those come from? How did you end up with these wooden and metal signs that say Tioga Pass Road or such and such passes closed or whatever you have here?
I hope the park people aren't listening to you right now because they'll wonder, where did I get those signs right there? Well, they were just, I happened to run across them, and sometimes they'd leave them someplace and I'd pick them up. I didn't want to discard them, so I brought them home.
So these are ones that have been replaced by a newer sign or something like that?
They were replaced by metal signs. And I think little by little, they're going back to some of the wooden signs again because people don't like the metal signs. You know, they'd rather see something rustic.
It doesn't seem like you've slowed down much here. You're 91 years old, but you can still pick up a chainsaw and get to work out here. What's your secret? What keeps you so young at 91?
You're looking at her. She keeps me young. I'll tell you. I don't know what I'd do without her, but she knows what I can do and what I can't do, and she sees that I do it.
And you two have been married for 45 years. You have a daughter and six grandkids. When you're thinking about or answering questions like you have today about World War II, and you're thinking about that mine that went off, or the shrapnel that was in your arm, or the stuff that went into your helmet, and all these situations where you were that close to not coming home. Has it ever hit you that you never would have met your wife and that your daughter and those grandkids wouldn't be here?
No, I never gave that a thought. I never thought I'd get married. I just thought I'd come home. That's all I wanted to do, just come home and go back to gold mining and fooling around like that. But oh, I thought maybe someday I'd get married. I didn't know it then.
Did you ever go back to gold mining?
No, just maybe for pleasure. I'd go out and do a little panning, but not serious like I was when I was a kid.
You think there's anything still out there?
There's lots of it.
Well, I don't want to forget to ask you about something you mentioned, honor flight. You got to go back to Washington, D.C. and see the National World War II Memorial and other memorials with a bunch of other veterans who were in the same place as you were. What was that like for you? What did you get out of it?
Well, that was beautiful. I tell you, met a lot of people out there. I never got real friendly with a lot of them, just my guardian, and he was a wonderful person. As far as the flight, it was beautiful. Everything was great. There was so much to see that you wished you could have spent a month there. You got to see a lot of country. You got to see a lot of landmarks.
From the start of that trip to the finish, was there a moment within there that really stood out for you that made you feel like people got it, people appreciated what you and all those other people did for us?
Yes. When I went by the Vietnam Wall, I think I hung my head there, and I was probably, well, I was tearing up, and you should have seen the people that got around me to, you know, people that I'd never seen before. Not our group. It was people that were just standing around like that. There were foreigners. There were a lot of people that would just stop and say thank you, you know. It was wonderful to have people say thank you for something. And what can you say but you're welcome?
Well, let me join that parade and say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us a little bit of your story. Is there anything else that you think we need to know today, those of us who weren't around during World War II, who maybe don't understand how grave a situation it was for our country, how great a sacrifice it took to achieve victory? Is there anything else that you think we need to know?
I think we ought to pray for our government, that they will straighten up and get along and do better by the veterans and by the people that are fighting right now, and pay more attention to this country. It seems like we're going to pot over here, so we really pray for it.
From all your time in the service, especially over in Europe, what was the most difficult thing that you ever had to endure?
The cold was one, but then I don't compare it to what the other guys went through. You know, mine's just a little old, tiny thing when I think about them. They froze their feet, they lost their feet, and the cold and like that, where I might have got the heel of my, and my toes have got kind of burned a little bit, but not like those guys did.
Speaking of that freezing cold during the Battle of the Bulge, I know you described some of the horrific things you had to witness a little earlier, but your wife Susan tells me you also had some lighter moments with regard to German civilians you encountered. Can you tell us about that?
We were through with one part of the bulge, and they were sending us to Colmar, to another bulge. We were in convoy, and that night we stopped at a village someplace, and they had electric lights on. And we thought, man, you know, they got lights over here and everything, because we had been in the dark all the time. Just during the day we had daylight. But anyway, it was raining, and they let us out, and we had to put up tents, shelter halves, and my buddy and I, we saw this old barn, so we said, let's go to the barn and we'll stay there tonight. It was an old, knocked-down old barn. So we went out there and we got all fixed the hay up and everything and got all settled right there. And a woman came to the door and she said, no, 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 no. She said, no, no. And we thought, why, that old bag, you know, this and that and so forth. She said, no, not here. Coming, coming. We thought she was chasing us out, so we got our sleeping bags and started out. She made for us to follow her. We said, what? And she said, Housen, Housen, Housen. Oh, no, she said, we'll stay in the barn. No, 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 she said, not in here. She said, Housen. So we went to the house. She said, upstairs. So we went up the stairs, and she had a room up there, and there were two beds, one couch and one bed. And said, so I was a senior. I said, well, I'll take the bed, you take the couch. So he took the couch. I took the bed, and all the time we had been arguing with her, no, 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 this and that, you know. Anyway, we went to bed that night, and we couldn't sleep because they were down comforters, and everything was too soft and everything. We wound up laying on the floor with a down comforter on top of us, and that's how we slept. But that woman, she got rich because we gave her everything that we had, you know, candy bars, we get soap and toothpaste and everything that we could get rid of, we gave her because she'd been so nice.
Well, and I guess that kind of underscores, too, the reality that you weren't just fighting for the freedom of Americans. Really, you were fighting for that woman's freedom in her home country.
A lot of people were appreciative that way, you know. I remember one time we traded all our rations. We used to get a lot of beef and vegetable stew in little cans, and we didn't like that. We liked K rations, all right, but not that meat and vegetable stew. So we had a lot of those cans left over. We were in a house that had a whole bunch of apples. Now, they weren't the best apples in the world because they'd be cold and like that. But anyway, we helped ourselves to the apples and we got caught. People came up and caught us, but they didn't say anything. They just watched us. Well, we felt guilty, you know, so we said, we'll trade you. You know, so we gave them all our tinned hash. And they loved it, you know. They said, take all the apples you want. So anyway, they took all our hash and we took all the apples that we needed. We came out even. A lot of good things like that.
And it's clear that you focus on the good things in life. Amazing energy you still have at 91. Sarge Sargentini. Check out his photos and video at the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.